again, and welcome into another episode of the 86 Celtics Interviews. I'm Abby Chin. My friend, Cedric Maxwell, current radio analyst for the Celtics, was named MVP of the 1981 NBA Finals. He also won a second title with the Celtics in 1984. He scored 24 points against the Lakers in Game 7 of those 84 Finals after famously telling his teammates to climb on my back, boys. Max missed time the following season due to injury, and the Celtics lost in the NBA Finals rematch with those hated Lakers. He was then traded with a draft pick to the Los Angeles Clippers for Bill Walton. In Cedric's conversation with CSN producer Jim Aberdale and director Tori Champagne, we begin with the 1984 Finals win over the Lakers and work up to Max forging a peace treaty with Fred Auerbach.
I've never been in war. My father was in war, but that's the closest thing I could say I'd been in because it felt like we were in that kind of battle against the Lakers. It was a brutal series. It was as physical as the NBA probably will ever be again. Never will get to that point where, you know, you're throwing guys down out of the air, and you know, you were not only trying to chastise guys, but you were chastising mentally. Physically, there was physical abuse, there was, you know, emotional abuse. There was all these things that were going on in the game, and it was still a game of beauty, and it still goes down as one of the greatest series ever to be played. And to be here in Boston and to have those two teams meet, and Larry's team, as they say, and Magic's team meet at that particular time for the first time, and for the Celtics to win was just unreal. A bunch of guys that, you know, there were great players all over the place. There were probably like at least 7 or 8 Hall of Famers who were playing during that particular series. And to be there in the middle of it and to experience all the things that kind of went along was almost surreal.
Tell me specifically, let's move ahead to Game 7 and your quote, "Climb on my back, boys." Where did that kind of originate? What, you know, when did you say it exactly, and how did that just go down and you went out and delivered?
Well, we were actually in the locker room for the 7th game. We felt pretty good in L.A. when we played the 6th game there. We had the Lakers down by 10 points, I think, going into the 4th quarter. And matter of fact, we had put plastic on our clothes in the locker room because we thought that, you know, we were going to win. And Byron Scott, a young rookie, came in and scored 8 or 9 points in that quarter, in the 4th quarter, and they came back and they beat us in L.A. So we were pretty upset. We were bummed. We didn't win it in L.A., so we felt like we had to come back home. So it was a 7th game here in Boston, and I just remember all the circumstances, the day, almost to right to a T. I can remember it. I remember the fact that the game was a 9 o'clock game at night. It was a nationally televised 9 o'clock game, so it was going to start at 9, so the game would be in L.A., in Boston, all over the country. People were going to see it. So it kind of, first thing it did was knock you off your routine. Our routine was normally, I lived in Brookline at the time, in Jamaica, JP, and I would drive to the Garden. And always, there was always traffic on Star Road Drive. So coming in, I was, you know, in the 5 o'clock track. Well, this time instead, being there 2 hours before the game, I drove in on Star Road Drive, and it was like 7 o'clock or something like that. So there was no traffic. So that was the first thing that I always felt like I would have killed somebody, as amped up as I was. I remember about the day, but I had my nephew. And my nephew, who is now almost 35, 40 years old, he was like a young little lad. He was maybe like 1 and a half. And so I had a chance to play with him. And that gave me a chance really to calm down. And that was a great thing. Get to the arena, and we were all just sitting around. We were all amped up. And I remember Danny Ainge walking around, and that's a scope. You know, when the thing, the monitor for your hearts, Danny went in, Danny Ainge, went in and got one out of the doctor's office. And he said, what I'm going to do is I'm going to check your heart rate, check everybody's heart rate. So he checked the, you know, MLs. And Larry didn't really play that kind of stuff. So he wouldn't mess with Larry, but he'd check Kevin's, he'd check Roberts, he'd check Quinn's. I think, you know, Quinn's, he said, your heart's not even beating right now, so I don't even know if you're alive. Came over to me and checked me and said, yeah, your heart sounds strong. is, and they were talking about, you know, everybody in the locker room, like, well, you know, we're gonna do all these things, and this is what we're gonna do to the Lakers. And I was just sitting there, and I was still upset because I think I got pushed in the back by Worthy at the time, so I was still upset. I was the playoff MVP on that team that particular time. We didn't have anybody who else was. So I felt like it was my opportunity to step up. So we were talking about guys who were, I think it was Quinn and ML, that were talking about, well, you know, this is going to happen. We might need to use Larry, and we might need to use Kevin. I said, or, you know, Chief, I said, no, we don't have to do that. You know, you guys, I'll tell you what, I'm going to let you guys do this. I'll let you climb on my damn back. You know, and that's how we're going to win this championship. You get on my back, I'm going to carry you. And they all looked at me, and they just kind of just smiled. And went out during the game, and early in the game, I was scoring. I was doing essentially what I wanted to do against Kurt Rambis and Worthy and whoever else was guarding me at the time. And we stayed close enough at that time. And I think the guys sensed that I was playing well. They knew I was playing well, and they continued to give me the ball. And I was aggressive enough to go get the ball myself. So it was just a culmination of things which worked out for me as my team felt that I was able to do it. And they just kind of rode the crest, rode the wave.
And then when you guys won it, we look at the video all the time as we're putting this together at work at the office in Burlington, and we can see the emotion, you just going crazy in that locker room. What was it like to, and you just said it was war against these guys. What was the seventh game? It could have went the other way easily. To go out there and to deliver on what you said and beat those guys right there.
Beat them in the Old Garden for the seventh game of the NBA championship. And to remember that day when I was driving in, I said, there's going to be somebody who's going to leave that locker room who's going to be sad tonight. You know, everybody's pumped up. These are two great franchises meeting. There's one of the guys I've always idolized, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. In college, I wore the number 33 because I love Kareem, you know. And so Bob McAdoo was on the other team, and he was a good friend of mine. He didn't end up playing in the series because he was hurt, but he was a great friend of mine. And so it was guys who I knew on that team, who I idolized on that team, but then I knew that the guys that I love, my brothers, we're all going to be here, and we had to deliver and win. The emotion, the relief of winning that game was—it was like somebody had just taken an anvil, or taken a big weight and took it off your chest. I remember one time having like an asthma, and then when you start to really breathe and your lungs open up, that's kind of how I felt. You know, after that game, it was just—I don't know if it was much excitement as it was just relief. That you were sitting there and you had won. And then to play the kind of game I played. I remember Quinn Buckner coming up to me after the game. And he said, boy, you played a hell of a damn game. He said, without you, we wouldn't have won this game. He said, you were one of the reasons, you were the reason why we won this game. And you get that from a teammate. And it is so gratifying. Remember Larry coming up and giving me a big hug, and Chief, and you know, we were just all kind of celebrating in the moment, and it was just a thing that we had been together so long. We had, Kevin, Larry, Chief, and myself had all come in and won the first championship, and then went through all the turmoil, and then to go back and win it, you know, KC's first year, that was just a very special, special moment.
And the last thing on this series before we move on to the next stuff is just, I know that, again, you know, colorful side, we know you now as a broadcaster, and you certainly had that when you were playing as well. Some of the things just researched a little bit, you know, you definitely were able to antagonize the opponent a little bit, specifically Worthy. I read one thing about game four where you did the joke with him, and then another where I guess you wore the Rambis glasses and shot in front of the Rambis youth. So just tell us about those two incidents and about really kind of getting under there.
That was the thing. James Worthy, Hall of Famer. Not a close friend, but I knew him. He's from Gastonia, North Carolina, and I played in Charlotte. So he had a chance to see me when he was in college, when he was in high school. I was in college, and I was legendary. Right at UNCC going to the Final Four. And it was, I was going to be matched up against him. So psychologically, physically, I knew James Worthy was a better player than I was, that his physical skills. But psychologically, I knew I had to get in his head somehow. And even today, I've read stories that James Worthy said, you know, there were a lot of, they asked him questions. So, well, who was one of your toughest opponents in the NBA when you played? They go, well, you know what? There was one guy. He wasn't the best player I ever played against. But that damn Cedric Maxwell had damn cornbread. I hated his ass. He said, I used to just sleep. And when I'd go to sleep, I'd wake up when Garrett played the Celtics, and I would just be like, foaming at the mouth trying to get to him because he had gotten under my skin. And there were things I said to him, and they weren't nice at all, but that is the way you play the game. And that is one thing I loved about playing during the 80s that we can't do, that you don't see anymore. You can't see a guy try to get into another guy's head because the NBA has come more like golf now. Oh, okay, I'm not going, yeah, it's okay. No, that's how the game sometimes is played. It's a street game, where you try to beat a guy not only physically, but you beat a guy psychologically. And that's what I wanted to do. Now with Worthy, with Rambus, I was out in LA and we were practicing. And these guys all had these Rambus glasses on. They were called the Rambus Youth. That's who they were. And they loved Kurt Rambus. And so the guy was like, Maxwell, you can't guard Rambus. You ain't crap. You know, you're horrible. You're terrible. And so I just went over and I said, dude, seriously, you think that I can't guard Rambus? The guy goes, no, you can't guard Rambus. So I said, I got the ball. I got the glasses, the Rambus glasses. I said, let me use your glasses. Put them on. I said, how can a man who can't see and shooting to the side going to ever guard me? And they all start laughing. We all start laughing. But that's the way we were as players. There was a game within the game almost all the time. It just wasn't the game. But there was always an undertone that went along with playing the game.
So you guys win the title. Life is great here in Boston. And then there's, you know, another great team in 1984-85. Tell me, what happened in 84-85 with your health? You played 57 games in the regular season, started 51 of those, but obviously there were some injuries. And when we got to the playoffs, there were some real issues. So what happened with your health in 84-85?
Well, 84, I first of all, when I got back in 80, it was 84-85, the next season after we won the championship, I didn't have a contract. So I went through contract negotiations with the Celtics. And there was a slight holdout. And the holdout was I didn't do a lot of camp because I was just trying to get the contract right. It was going to be one of my last contracts. So we all sat down and we talked about it. We finally got together. I came back to camp and finished signing the contract. But when I did my physical, we didn't do physicals at the time. And my knee was already bothering me. I had some soreness, but I really didn't think much of it. It was my eighth year in the league, so I thought it was just general wear and tear. And so the season started, and it was a pretty good season. We were playing well. And I got probably at about 50 games. And every game started getting worse. It was one night when I was laying in bed, and I remember turning to the side, turned my knee a certain way, and I just yelled. I woke up in the middle of it and I finally found out that what I had was I had a partial tear of the cartilage, had a cartilage tear, and that part of the meniscus was getting caught in the bone and would rip at night or if it got caught in a certain way, and it was extremely painful. Now I was telling the team about it, and I think that was the first time I got kind of irritated because they said, well, nothing's wrong with your knee because there's no swelling. If that happened, your knee would swell. I'm like, well, no, I know my knee is hurt. You know, if you're an athlete, you know when you have a bald spot, you have a tire, something's wrong with your car. You know, well, that was my bald spot. What I remember doing was finally my knee, we played the Lakers, of all teams, played the Lakers in L.A., tried to play the game and got in the middle of the game at halftime and couldn't straighten my knee out. it was the only way I could strain my knee. I had to kind of kick it forward. So they finally said, okay, well, we're going to send you back to Boston to get a doctor to look at it. So I flew back to Boston after the game and started missing games and got back here. And they said, well, we're going to scope your knee. So they went in and scoped my knee, and they found out that there was a tear in the cartilage and there was a lot of arthritic damage because of that. And then it was just I had to sit out, and I wasn't able really to play. And I didn't come back until I might have missed maybe 20, 25 games, 30 games, something like that, like the whole month of March. So it was very frustrating. Then finally I came back, and it never was right.
So you came back, and again, looking at it, you did play 20 games in the playoffs coming off the bench. Mm-hmm. Just tell me about, it didn't seem like from looking at the box score, obviously the effectiveness wasn't where it was, and tell me about how you were still hurt at that point. And secondly, kind of to roll into that, we're now at a year later, you guys win the Memorial Day Massacre 148-40, 114 in game one of the finals, but you end up losing that series here at the Garden. So tell me about how awful that whole situation was. You can't really contribute. You've lost the series. It just must have been a nightmare.
Yeah, it was bad. It was very bad. And I think that two things happened. I knew when I got hurt, there were a lot of things. People were questioning my integrity about, you know, you're not hurt. And that really bothered me. That bothered me more than anything. And it was not only like the, you know, maybe management, but it was my teammates that I felt that way. And I knew that I knew I was hurt. And I was a winner. I'm a winner. And whatever I've done, I've been a winner. So I would never try to not play. There was pressure on me to play, but I've always performed in high school, college, in the pros. Whenever my number has been called, I've been able to step up. But at that time, because of my injury, I wasn't able to do that. I think I played one or two games that I played really well. Played against Detroit and came off the bench. I might have had 25 points or something. It was on Mother's Day. I remember being interviewed after the game, and they were like, well, you're back. And I'm thinking like, no, not really. I'm back physically, but, I'm back in spirit, but physically I wasn't back. I was back, and so it was really hard. And then it was just, it went back and forth about, you know, I played a little bit, and then it was, you know, I was working out, and I was trying to do all these things, trying to rehabilitate at the same time and playing, whereas now you see guys take off completely until they come back and they're healthy. I understood we were trying to win the championship. I understood that was important to the cause. But I was going to get healed and I was going to be well in God's time. Not in Red Auerbach's time, not in the Celtics' time, but in God's time. And it just took longer than I wanted and they wanted, and that was just really bad.
You told us again in 84 about the highs. Any particular lows that you can take us into the locker room or afterwards? I know, again, I've read so much about this, just the insane competitive level of DJ in particular, but everybody, just anything that comes to mind about just how upsetting it was and what people were, how they acted, reacted.
Well, I think one of the things that we knew, that the era had changed. I remember at the end of the game against the Lakers, it was myself, ML, and Quinn Buckner. We all went into the trainer's room, and they had a little equipment room. And we all got in huddle, and we all gave each other a huge embrace. But it was, we all had shed tears because we knew that that was over. We knew that era was over. I think Quinn did not have a contract. ML was in his last year. I had signed a new contract. But as they were telling me, and we knew that, you know, I was going to be that person they're probably going to trade. The most upsetting thing about that was, again, questioning my integrity. That was very upsetting. But the crazy part about it was that there were still four guys who were Hall of Famers. And I think if there was one thing that I felt was, why did I have to be the scapegoat? yeah, we lost, but that was how it worked out. But at the end of the day, you know, I was the reason why. I was out basically in all the books, in Larry's book or in Red's book or whatever, was, you know, Max didn't come back. He, physically, I couldn't. And when you have four guys who are going to be future Hall of Famers, why do you point to the other guy over there and say, well, we lost because, you know, you didn't play? Well, this tells you how important I was, tells you what I was to the organization. There's a very fine line when you play a sport and the chemistry of a team. I knew that, you know, psychologically and spiritually, I was one of the leaders of that team. But because I was hurt, a lot of that went away. And so I wasn't able to contribute the way I wanted to contribute in that series.
Okay, so 85 ends, you guys have lost the series. You knew changes were coming. You told me about Red already, about why he blamed you, for Hall of Famers. Now we get to the summertime. You know you're going to get traded. Mm-hmm. And this was a long, drawn-out process. Tell me about how that worked for you in June, July, August. It even went to September of this back and forth and reading about it in the papers. If it was in Twitter today, this world, it would have been like the biggest thing in the world, we say to everybody. So tell me about that process in 30 years.
Well, the process 30 years ago was we were kind of, I kind of knew. I'd heard from the Clippers that, you know, they wanted to make the trade. Don Chaney, former teammate of mine, was now the head coach with the Clippers. And Bill Walton had made inquiries about trying to finish his career in Boston. So they came to me with the idea, like, well, you know, we can trade you to the Clippers. And I was so upset because of all the negativity around me that I did whatever I could to try to make that trade happen. The trade was going to happen. And physically, I had to go to L.A. To the Clippers for them to, you know, give me a physical. Well, they went on, and this was maybe 3 months later after the season had ended, so the rehab, and I'm still rehabbing. I go in, they look at my right knee, the knee which was actually, it was my left knee, which actually had the surgery on it and the repairs. And they said, well, your left knee is still kind of weak, and which I was like, I understood that. But said, your right knee is worse than your left knee. So we can't make this trade. So in order to have the trade made, I had to go out to L.A. to rehab, stayed at the, I always loved this, at the Marriott Airport. I stayed out there for a month rehabbing, working with a team doctor and a team guy. It was actually a coach for UCLA who was the track coach. And I was running up and down the hills in L.A., out at the beach. You know, he's working me during all these times. So to get my knee back to the point where I could, the trade could go on. And so finally, when I got my knee strong enough, they said, well, okay, we can finally make this trade, and the trade is done. I remember Jan Vogt sending me a letter. Man, he was a VP of the Celtics at the time, general counsel. Sent me this letter, and I laughed today. The letter said, Max, you had a great career here. You know, we appreciate everything you did. Sign this waiver, and now you're traded. Good luck. And that's how I ended up getting traded. And that was done. Send them back, FedEx sent them back that paperwork, and then the trade was done.
Did you have any conversations with Red and Jan that summer? Was there, or Larry, was there any other conversations that took place about you being traded? I know that you just said that you were kind of like potentially for the
absolutely race. Absolutely none. There were no conversations at all. I never talked to Red. I never talked to Larry. I never talked to, I don't think, any of my teammates. And at that time, you know, there was no cell phones. Guys, you'd have to call somebody on their home phone. And I don't think I had Larry's home phone, nor did he have mine. I don't think none of us really had each other's home phone where we were trying to communicate. We didn't have that kind of team that, you know, we met on the court and then after the season we'd meet again. So, it was, I felt isolated too, very isolated. The only person I talked to about this basically was my attorney, and he was telling me what was about to happen or what could happen. When I did get traded, I ended up losing a lot of money because I wanted that trade that badly. Gerald Henderson got traded a year before and signed a contract. And when he left, his attorney ended up getting them an all-cash deal. Now, what I mean by that, during that particular time, I think I was making about $900,000 a year, but the NBA at the time had something called a deferred payment. So they were only paying me half of that. And that made actually the $900,000 made me the 99th, I love this, the 99th highest paid athlete in the world at that time, which was really cool. But you were only getting half that money. So my attorney wanted to say, well, let's go to the Celtics and let's get all the money in cash, or the Clippers and get it all in cash, and then we'll make the trade. I said, I don't care about that. I just want to be traded. I want to wish them well, and I hope they wish me well. And there was a contract I had with a shoe company. It was Pony Shoe Company. It was $150,000 a year. Well, that contract, when I got traded and went to the Clippers, that was like toilet paper, because that's what it was. That contract was null and void. So I lost a lot of money in that process of arrogance, of ignorance, of all those things, because I just wanted it to happen. I was just very soured by what I perceived to be as total disrespect to somebody who had played as hard as I had played, won multiple championships, played in a bunch of big games, not only the get on my back and the series to get there, but all the other series which led up to that. I'd always been there and always been a rock to play.
You helped the Celtics out, like we talked about, and you told me just now, by going to the West Coast. You know, if you hadn't done that, the trade would have been rescinded, as we just talked about. And now, final few questions here. One thing was, just on a personal note for you, what was it like to read about, you know, coming back that year, and you got a standing ovation? But obviously, at least you read that there was one guy sitting that didn't stand up, and that was Red. And what? How did that feel? And then what had ended up happening with Red, and as the years went on?
Well, you know, it was really cool coming back here for that game, and it was the press met our plane when we flew in, and they wanted to talk to me. Everybody wanted to talk to me, and I said, no, I'm just going to wait. And we didn't have these press conferences with players, so I just wanted to wait until I got to the game. And I don't even think I came out to warm up, and I'd never been in the visiting locker room, so I didn't know what it was like over there. So to get there and then to see my – and I think we had played the Celtics already in L.A., and I had gotten sick the game before. I had the I ended up getting food poisoning. So all my teammates said I had the bird flu. I didn't want to see Larry. So I laughed about it, but then came back here. So my first game actually against the Celtics was here in Boston. And, you know, when they announced my name, and it was really cool. It was really cool to see the appreciation that my teammates gave me. First of all, I looked down at them, and I saw all of those guys standing. To see the entire arena standing, to go out in the middle of the court, and I don't remember looking up to see if Red was sitting or not. And I guess he was sitting. He was one of the few people who wasn't standing, but it was really special, considering that I was that fallen angel, that person who had left. You know, now you see all the video tributes to people. For me to see Paul Pierce come back here and to see the video tribute up on the Jumbotron. There was no Jumbotron when I played. And then they'll, you know, do all these special things. That was really cool. So that year went on and we played them. We ended up losing to the Celtics. And to watch them from afar and to see how well they were playing, I was a little envious about that. I was envious because that was my team. That was my team I had played on. And to see now that it was one of the greatest teams to ever play, minus me. And even then too, I guess more so to see now there was something called the Big Three. And it was Kevin and Robert and Larry. They were the big three. Well, I was the big three and a half. Maybe I, you know, I'm not sure how many Beatles there were. I mean, there was four Beatles. I always said it was might have been a fifth guy or whatever. I always felt like that. I was like that other guy. It was still understood the politics of it, understood everything that happened in it, and it was just something that was meant to be. My only regret with the Celtics at that time when I got traded going back was I remember saying in the paper, I wish them luck and I hope they have much success. I hope they win. I just hope that they wish the same thing for me. And I didn't feel like that came. There was still, you know, words from Red, the words from other teammates undertones about, you know, how I didn't try. Look, at that point, it's over. I'm traded, you're traded, now we go on. Then we move on maybe, you know, 5-6 years later, now I'm watching Larry's health go down. I'm watching, you know, back problems. I'm watching Kevin. I'm watching Chief. I'm watching all these guys and saying, wow, you know, it's just a shame that, you know, that their careers are going to end, you know, essentially like mine, because you get older and you start to have problems. They had at the time they were tearing down the Garden. So they had an event that they were bringing back all the players. And they would have a special basketball card for that player. It was a ticket, actually. And they gave it to the fans, and then they would have your day. And then you come out, and, you know, they would essentially just like, you know, like woo you, like, you know, hey, great being back, you know. So I came in, and Jan Vogt, they honored me, and Jan Vogt came, and he said, Max, we'd like to have you back in the organization. I'd been away for about 5 hours. I was like, okay. And ML Carr was the head of basketball operations, one of my best friends now. He said, but the only way we can have you back with the organization is that you, I love this part, you have to go apologize to Red. I'm like, I got traded. You traded me, won the championship. Why would I be apologizing to Red Auerbach? And Jan Vogt, I always remember these words, the father never apologizes to the son. And I was like, wow, that is really deep. So I took it in stride, and I didn't want to, you know, get back with the organization, and it was, you know, a way to get back in and do television and radio, and that's what I wanted to do now after my career. I didn't want to coach. So I called Red up and I said, Red, I'd like to come to your house and do this personally. You know, that's the way I've always wanted to do things. So I flew to Washington, as nervous as I've ever been in my life. Not even for a seventh game was I this nervous. I'm sitting there, I get to Washington, I find this house in Georgetown. It brings me in. I don't know what's going on. Red's there, his wife's there. He brings me in, he puts his arm around me, he says, takes me in his little room, he shows me all this stuff, all the letters openers he's had over the years he's collected. He puts his arm on me and says, Max, I just want to say, sometimes when you're young, we don't do smart things. And then he looked at me and said, I forgive you. Forgive me? What the hell did I do? But at that point, I knew at that point, I was back in the door, in his good graces. It was more important about being in his good graces than for me to, my ego to be, leave my ego at the door, leave it in check. So that was one of those moments again where I just kind of looked and laughed. But, and that's when Red and I had a kind of a peace treaty. And that was a really cool moment though.
You know, you look at this 85-86 team, you know, what did you see, you know, playing against them? And you had said to me at the office as well, just that once you left, you said that they were better without you, or it was different. What did you think of them as a great team of all time, and how great they were?
They didn't have any holes. There were very few holes they had. You're looking at Kevin McHale as one of the greatest power forwards ever to play the game. Larry Bird, one of the greatest players to ever play the game. Robert Parrish, all these guys were in their prime. Dennis Johnson. Then you got you know, Bill Walton, who for that one season mustered his, you know, put his foot beat back together and played, you know, played inspired basketball. Then they grabbed all these other guys who were just kind of misfits and put them together on that team, and they all worked as a unit. There was, you know, then you put Danny Ainge in the middle of that. So you had all these great players who had one goal, and that one goal was to be one of the greatest teams ever. And that's exactly what they did, looking from afar. There were, when you had Robert playing the way he was, still a bedrock, Larry playing MVP-like, even to the point, I think one of the problems they had, actually, I think that Kevin got to be so great, Kevin McHale got to be so great that the hierarchy kind of got rocked a little bit, because for that one year or so, you know, Kevin was, to me, as good as Larry was, maybe as a MVP-like in the league. One of the problems you have when you have a great team is you have to have, you have one chief. No pun on Robert Parrish, but you have one chief, and that chief was Larry Bird. All the people around him, those were the Warriors. And I think at that point you had two guys who were kind of, their camps were in the middle of it. So I think you threw off the balance. As great as they were, I think they were almost too great in a sense that they didn't have that one guy. They had that maybe one and a half guys, that's two guys who were battling to be the best player on that team.
And you also told me that Bill Walton back then and even up till now is very grateful for that.
Oh my God, Bill Walton. Oh, even today we see, Max, I just want to say you dove on the sword for me. Thank you. You gave me my life back. Without you sacrificing for me, and then that was on and on and on. I was like, oh my God, Bill, come on with it. And then it was real, real funny. Me and Bill have had a tie-in every time he sees me at different events. We one of the last times we saw each other, I think we saw each other in Dennis Johnson's funeral, and they had a memorial for him. And they were asking, Donna, his Dennis Johnson's wife, asked me to speak and was asking Bill to speak, one of us to speak. And so, you know, she said, well, Max, you were one of Dennis's best friends, so you get up and speak. So I get up on the podium. I'm going, I know Dennis Johnson right now is looking down going, Max, good speech. He's like, thank God you didn't let Bill talk or I would have never got married. So we'd still be going there right now. But Bill was that kind of guy. So we have that. People ask me a lot of times right now, hey, you played with Bill Walton with the Celtics. No, I got traded for Bill Walton. That's how Bill Walton got to be. And a lot of people didn't know that that was the trade. Matter of fact, the Celtics gave the Clippers. Was myself and their first round pick at that time. In the Bill Walton trade.
Walton at that time had declined so much before that 86 season, and he was still a good player, but was there a part of you when you got to LA and you started to see him be in all of his health and all of his kind of have this magical season where you were like, are you kidding me? Like, damn.
No, not really. When Bill Walton had that great season, it was that, what happens with a lot of players. They get that, you know, it's like Bill Belichick gets them all the time. He'll get one great guy, and he'll come in for one year, and he's just unreal. Then health-wise, he just falls off the podium. I knew that was going to happen because Bill Walton's feet, he had bad feet. He does these commercials all the time. I have bad feet. Go to good feet. But, you know, I knew that he wasn't going to be, I knew it was going to be a one-and-done deal. Whereas I knew I was going to play another 5 years. I was going to be around, and I was going to be productive. But at that time, the chemistry of the team had to change. And I understood that. I understood the chemistry of the team was going to change when I saw Kevin McHale score 56 points when I got hurt. He played, it was against Detroit. They had 56 points. So I was like, well, that'll be the last time I'll be starting. That's probably it right there. So there were a lot of things about that year, you know, that time that I understood. We all kind of laughed about. We all loved each other. We had a great time, but it was just a very unique family bond. I mean, one of the stories I think I always remember, and this could be, you could use this, but I remember Kevin McHale's mother coming to a game. And what we did as team, because we were so close to the team during those 80s, that we all would see somebody else's parents and we and their mother, we'd all just grab them and we'd just like, you know, hug them like they were our mom. And I remember seeing Kevin's mom, and I was close to Kevin. And I go up and I, oh, Miss McHale, hey, how you doing? I go and I give her a big hug. And what I remember, that even to this day, I've never really said this, even to this day, I just remember Mrs. McHale cringing because I was like, and she was like, I knew it was the first time a black person had ever probably hugged her because she's from Hibbing and they weren't used to seeing people of color. So when I grabbed her, I just felt her just in her skin. And I just felt the same way, like, oh my God, I can't believe that. Because I didn't connect one to the other. But as a family, that's what we did. We would look at somebody else's mom. Oh, that's Kevin's mom. Hey, how you doing, Miss McHale? And I said, oh my God, she's from Hibbing. They've never really seen black people except on TV. So it was just really one of those moments I even now laugh about and haven't told that many people, but now you guys know.
Just big picture stuff. We, you know, again, we've talked to Bob Ryan and Shaughnessy and Peter May and Jackie, and we really want to try to put into context that great question that the sport of the NBA provides, sport of basketball, just is this the greatest team of all time? Where does it compare to the 96 Bulls, this year's Warriors, the 70s, you know, the 72 Lakers, et cetera, et cetera?
Yeah, I think they were. I think they're among the greatest teams of all time. I think you also look at longevity. That was a supernova that all of a sudden exploded. It was just there, and then it was gone. They had that 1 year, and then the wheels fell off. Everybody started getting hurt. They started getting injured. I remember the one game they lost that year at home, Magic hits a running bank shot to deny them the ultimate, going 41-0 at home. They were a great basketball club, and one of the greatest ever put together. Are they the greatest? I wouldn't know if they were. I wouldn't say they were the greatest because of the, and I would only say that because of the longevity. I think greater teams. You tell me that as great as that team was, how many championships did they win together? They won one. They won one championship. You win two, you win two, they won one. I won two, and I was with them, but, you know, they won one and with the great players they had. And you look at the guys again, the guys who are there on that team. You had five Hall of Famers. Whit Walton were on that team at that time. A basketball IQ, unbelievable. Casey Jones at the helm, who had won, like, 10 championships. It was just a match made in heaven at that time. It was a special time, even as envious as I was to see them play and to win and want to beat them. It was a special time to see a team that was that talented and guys who were at the height of their power. Kevin, Robert, Larry were all at the height of their power. They were as great as they were going to ever be at that particular time. And to watch them perform, it was almost like watching a concert, going to a great concert. And me being one of the people who had, you know, used to be in the band, now I'm in the audience, right, watching this performance. So I was envious, but it was unique for me to see that perspective of being with those guys and then playing against those guys. I think that was really different.
Well, I sat down with Danny last week, and he just talked highly of you. Can you just recall Danny coming into the fold with the team, just the unique circumstances, and just kind of what a pistol he was from the get-go? He seemed pretty fearless and just kind of getting
into it. Yeah, Danny was fearless. We were such a close group of guys that we didn't know who Danny Ainge was. You know, there wasn't no highlight package on him. We saw him play in college, but who really cared about that? We were a very competitive bunch of guys. I remember the first day we got Danny, and I was on the sideline, and we were at Hellenic College where we used to practice, and Danny started shooting, and shooting, and shooting, and missing, and missing, and missing, and I was on the sideline, 1-for-4, one for six, one for 12, one for 13, one for 18. I'm like, Jesus, why did we get this guy in the first place? What the hell do we want him for? And Danny later on said, Bill Fish went up to him and said, man, the game's a lot tougher right now than you might have thought, huh? And Danny says, no, man, I just missed a bunch of shots because I normally make them. But, and I remember Danny's confidence at that time was really low because Danny had had great success in college. And one day I said, it was my project one day, Kevin McKellar and I, we laugh. If you tell Kevin this story right now, the day we all would laugh. And Danny, they didn't believe Danny could shoot. Nobody in the NBA. Danny turned out to be one of the great shooters. So I said, Danny, what I'm going to do is I know what they're going to do. You're going to pass the ball into me. They're going to double team me because they're afraid that I'm going to score. They have to double team me. You move to a spot, and what I'm going to do is I'm going to kick you the basketball. So we did that in practice. I did this on my own, not with coaches. This is how we were as a team. So about 30 minutes, we're working on it. Danny throw the ball into me. He'd move. I'd throw it back out to him. He knocked down the shot. We did this 30 minutes, just all over the court. Pass into me. They're going to double. Your man's going to double. I'm going to kick it to you. You find the open spot. Worked on 30 minutes. Knocking down shots, not missing. Get in the game. Danny Ainge, first play, gets in, throws it to me. They come, like I say, they're going to double team me. Your man doesn't believe you can shoot. Come to me. Danny goes to spot up. I zip it back out to him. He catches it, lines up for a shot, shoots it, hits the side of the backboard. Oh, my God. His confidence just went. And then I remember Kevin McHale said, hey, that was a bunch of crap right there. It worked, you deal with Danny. And we all just laughed. But that was Danny Ainge in a nutshell. And even today, Danny would tell you that story. And it was just funny. But that was how we worked as a unit. We wanted everybody to have that success. And I kind of adopted Danny. Danny took me out to Utah with him. We had he had a basketball camp. I lost some bet to Danny, and he had a basketball camp in Utah. Wanted me to speak. So I never went to go to Utah, but I went out there. And Danny ended up taking me up in the hills, we're up in the mountains, and we're up, and Danny had a little truck, and, you know, we got to start walking. Danny had gone someplace, and as we were walking, this guy come flying up in another truck. White guy comes flying up. He has one of them rifle racks on the back, and I'm going, he's like, who? I was like, I'm with Danny. Hey, I'm with Danny. With Danny Ainge. And so Danny even laughs about that now, but it was just so funny. But that's how we were as a team, you know, just coming together. And, you know, that was how I got my relationship with Danny. And that's why I've always kind of loved Danny. Danny was a puppy. Even his son, they used to bring his son to, it was Austin, who now works for the Celtics. He would bring his son and his daughter over to my house for Halloween. And I remember, you know, his daughter being in at that time, it was Bert and Ernie were the two Sesame Street characters. So Austin he wanted to be Ernie because he felt like Ernie was a good one. So his sister was Ernie. So I asked him, I was like, Austin, who are you? He just looked at me and went, Bert. I'm burnt. And we just all just cried, laughed about it. So I see Austin now, I don't even say it anymore, but that was, I see him now as a grown up and see how things have gone on. But that was just funny to see how he was at that time.
That wraps up our series of the 86 Celtics interviews. A big thanks to Jim Aberdale and Tori Champagne for collecting all of these great interviews and putting together an incredible, fascinating documentary for CSN. You can find out more about this special podcast series on CSNNE.com or by searching for the 86 Celtics on Audioboom, iTunes, Stitcher, and other podcasting apps. I am Abby Chin. Thank you so much for listening.